the first time discovered ever by the human being. And they theorized, the scientists theorized about that, trying to find out the mystery of our moon and how the our moon was created. And one of the theories of so-called creation of our moon was that the planet named Theia, T-H-E-I-A, shared the same orbit around the Sun as Earth. And eventually, two planets met and collided with the Great Force, completely destroying Theia. Eventually, all the debris would have either settled back on the Earth, or some, that's what I know about it. Back to you.
This mathematician named Lagrange found out, 100 or 200 years ago, why he was studying orbits. I guess he was doing it after Kepler had done his thing, and we abandoned the Ptolemaic system. He found that there were at least five separate places in space in orbit where you can form a kind of stability. One of the Lagrange points is a certain distance between Earth and the Sun. Another one is almost the same distance away from the Sun. There's one that's on the possible backside of the Sun. But you do have two other places in the exact same orbit where, as far as measuring angle from the Sun itself, if you put a second object at the exact same orbit as the first object, and you make the angle between the two from the Sun's point of view 60 degrees ahead or 60 degrees behind, I think that's called Lagrange point number 4 and 5, you have a completely stable orbit, believe it or not. So having two planets around the same Sun can, under careful conditions, be a stable condition where they won't necessarily one, you know, crawl up on the other and eventually collide. They used to also think that it's impossible to have planets going around a binary star system. As you know, our Sun is a unary. It's just one star all by itself. But there are more binaries than there are unaries out there in space. So various people used to predict you couldn't have a stable planetary system around a binary. Well, they found one of those. So almost everything is possible. From one point of view, you can say this is the most random of all possible universes. You can say it's all very ordered, and we just don't understand all the rules yet. Let me drop. It's complicated, but as Kepler is looking at more than 100,000 stars, and it's already found more than 1,000 planets, and it's going to be finding more of them as time goes on, I think we're going to find out that there's a lot of life capability, a lot of life possibility out there, and the chances of us being alone is pretty slim as I see it. There are many people guessing that those UFOs that are occasionally seen, there are other groups looking at us, if you know what I mean, is a possibility. And to think that that all of this creation of the universe, the solar system, the galaxies, and life on this particular planet, to think that it only happened once and nowhere else, it has to be pretty arrogant to think that we're the only ones. There's a whole lot of jokes about somebody going to heaven saying that this particular faith is the only group there. John had a question, I think. Now we're going to go into the more serious section of the TechNet. This is the one where we're digging into the atomic level, among other things. So, John, I think you've got one of those more deep questions. AC2WGB, A2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2WGB. Yes, Dave, I'd like you and Mel to comment on an example I'm going to give you. It's on an LC circuit. Let me let it drop. We'll have a condenser and an inductor in parallel, and let's say it resonates at 1 megahertz. We pulse it. It has a specific ring down time or decay. Let's say it's 1 second at 1 megahertz. Got that concept?
Sure do. And the usual definition of time constant is how long it takes for 1 over E. You know, time constants are usually represented mathematically as 1 e to the minus t over RC, where RC is the time constant, and t is time, and so on. So 1 time constant is 1 over E left, which means 67% of the decay has occurred, and 33% is left. Or I may have it backwards. 63% is decay has occurred, and 37% of the original amplitude is left. Because if you have a high enough gain oscilloscope and you're watching something that is resonant ring down, it never goes to zero. It gets closer and closer. So you have to make some decision as to what you're going to call a time constant. And the time constant is 1 over E, where E is the natural logarithm, 2.718. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, very well, Dick. Okay, now, we're going to see the capacitor's vertical and the inductor's vertical simple circuit. We're going to pulse it, and we measure, let's say, the ring down time, or the decay, and it's X. Now, if we add a tuned antenna to the top of that circuit at 1 megahertz, will the ring down time be briefer? Will it truncate that ring down time, or the decay?
Absolutely. In fact, there's a little more to the circuit, too. When you measure the equivalent series resistance of that inductor, X sub L over R determines the natural Q, the quality factor of the inductor. The capacitor has a natural quality factor. It's also got an equivalent series resistance, X sub C divided by R. And so, mathematically, if you know the quality of your inductor, and you know the quality of your capacitor, and you're using them thoroughly unloaded, you know exactly what the time constant is for ring down. There's some pretty solid mathematics on that. But now when you say, I'm going to pulse it, be careful. If you are pulsing it by taking a single generator that's running at, in your example, 1 megacycle, and for a short period of time you close a switch, and you pump energy from your signal generator into the circuit, and then you open the switch so that your signal generator is not presenting a load to the circuit. And by the way, let me backtrack. In reality, the inductor has an equivalent series resistance. Let me drop. The capacitor has an equivalent series resistance. With a little bit of mathematical transformation, you could redraw the circuit as not a series LR in parallel with a series RC. You could now make a perfect inductor, a perfect capacitor, and one simple shunt resistor, and you would have the exact equivalent if you choose the right value of the shunt resistor. So the real circuit naturally has an inductor that's ideal, a capacitor that's ideal, they're in parallel with each other, and across that there is some resistor which represents the ring down time, the retransposition of the two real resistors into one composite resistor. Your generator, if you don't have a way of thoroughly disconnecting it, adds to that shunt resistor. The antenna you put there, on the assumption the antenna is not a perfect open circuit at 1 megacycle, it has a load resistor. We usually call that the radiation resistor. So you've got a resistor created by the antenna, a resistor created by the signal generator, and a resistor from the RC itself. There really are three resistors, all in parallel with that circuit. So as those resistors become more dominant and you put more resistors there, the ring down time is going to get shorter and shorter, and that's pretty well-based mathematics. There's lots of lab experiments confirming that one, John. KC2WGB, let's see where you're going to go with this. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, very good, Dick. No, that answered my question. I was just wondering if the effect of the resistor, of the antenna tuned to that resonant frequency would cause the ring down time to truncate or decrease. So, perfect answer. Thank you very much.
And maybe I can explain it for those who are listening, Dick, because they're going to be confused.
Okay, I'm going to pass it over to you in a second, Mel. Another thing that's going to happen, Mel and John, when you added the antenna, The antenna will say is a 50 ohm resistance if you design it correctly and you've got a 50 ohm transmission line going through it. And now, in most circumstances, you don't want to put a 50 ohm resistor on top of an LC. The LC, the natural resistor that's there, might be represented by a 10,000 ohms, and you put a 50 ohm in parallel with that, boy, you're going to essentially kill it. You're probably going to connect the antenna in most cases by tapping down some number of turns up from ground on that inductor would be the proper tapping point. The antenna, unless it's a perfect antenna, has a little bit of reactance left over. In other words, at your operating frequency of your coil, the antenna is going to be a little bit capacitive or a little bit inductive. So you're really going to be adding another capacitor or inductor and slightly pulling the resonant frequency when you connect the antenna. Life ain't simple. So explain this all to us, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I'm going to try to explain it for those who are listening, but they keep saying, please, Mel, give us a little bit of a simpler explanation. If you envision, for instance, that you have a generator, and then you have a coil, and the other side of the coil, go through the coil, and you go and now connect the capacitor. You go through that capacitor, and now you connect the resistor. You go through that resistor, and you go back to the generator. Okay, now I'll show you simply. If you redraw that circuit, actually, the coil can be considered X of L, the inductive reactance. The capacitor will be called X of C, the capacitive reactance. In the circuit, you can now visualize that X of L will be minus X of C. In other words, X of L becomes X of L minus X of C. And then R, the resistance, is actually in series. I think maybe a little bit better visualization. Take over.
Yeah, when it comes to connecting an inductor and a capacitor, whether you're putting them in series or putting them in parallel, if you've only got the two objects there, becomes interesting. When you've got an L and a C, an inductor and a capacitor in parallel, at resonance, the capacitor reactance equals the inductor reactance. They're exactly opposite from each other, except for the shunt resistor equivalent. It becomes an open circuit. That's a parallel LC. A series LC at resonance becomes a short circuit. In either cases, you're left with a pure resistance at resonance. But you can get very different values depending on whether it's parallel or series. But if you're smart enough with the mathematics, every series circuit and every parallel circuit you've ever used, you can make an equivalent circuit of the opposite type. If I've got a black box, and I've got an L, C, and an R all in parallel with it, within that box, I can create a second black box where the L, C, and R are in series, and I can choose the values apportioned correctly. I'll get the exact same performance only at resonant frequency. Got to be careful now. One of the things that's one of the traps, let me drop. One of the traps that many an engineer has fallen into, and I'm one of those back in the early days, is that you go through all this great mathematics they teach you of an equivalent circuit, and you make the mistake of thinking that the equivalent circuit will give you the exact same performance. It does, but they don't tell you this caveat, only at that one frequency. In the case of a parallel circuit, when I go to a higher frequency than the resonant frequency, I see a capacitor. When I take a series circuit and I go to a higher frequency than the resonant frequency, I see an inductor. I see an inductor reactant. So away from resonance, away from the design frequency, the equivalent circuit is no longer equivalent in performance. That equivalency only works at one frequency. Burn that into your mind because you'll avoid a lot of equivalency. And there are times when a very complicated circuit with all kinds of, you got a great big matrix or a mesh, or what's the word, you got a lattice of L, C's, and R's. And if you're smart enough to choose this particular section and you convert that LCR that's in series, you convert it to a parallel, you combine it with something else that's in parallel, you can simplify a circuit. There's a step-by-step procedure in which a very complicated circuit can be made simpler. But be careful, all that simplification, in many cases, only works at the one frequency where the design was told to you, if you know what I mean. K2RIW in a second, listening.
K2KEY again.
Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, Dick Brothing, by saying the equivalent term. And basically, let me put it to you this way, so you can visualize it a little better. That's the way you can use, actually, in doing these type of mathematics, we use what looks like a triangle. In fact, that's what it is. You use a triangle and you use that for representing the different arms. But what is happening here, because we've got something else that's coming in here, and we just touched upon it, and that is there is what we call phases that we will go through, 0, 90 degrees, and 180 degrees. So when you talk about equivalent circuit, which converts resistance, reactance, in a combination from either series to parallel or vice versa, so that the resultant circuit is either series or entirely parallel, is subject to a little different mathematics in solving the problem. As Dick says, it's not really exact, over.
Yeah, the word phase angle and phase difference between current and voltage confuses the living daylights out of a lot of people. I'm going to try to make that a little bit clearer with a couple of simple examples. I've got a single generator. It doesn't matter very much if it's a 1 kilohertz sine wave generator, or if it's a 1 volt battery, or if it's a 1 megacycle single generator. I've got a single generator, and I put a pure resistor across the output terminals of that generator. I've got a pure resistor, and maybe it's a 50 ohm resistor. And now I connect my instrumentation, my oscilloscopes and other meters, so that I can measure the voltage that appears across the resistor and the current that appears across the resistor. There's various ways I can hook up a current sensing probe into one channel of an oscilloscope and a voltage sensing probe into another channel of the oscilloscope. And now I've got this oscilloscope displaying two waveforms. Horizontal is time, and the vertical axis is voltage in one case and current in the other case. With a pure resistor, those two curves will exactly follow each other. In other words, if it was a sine wave, the two sine waves will look like they can be laid on top of each other. And if it was a pure battery, the current and the voltage would follow Ohm's law as far as their proportionality. Let me drop. Now, if I take out that 50 ohm resistor that's across the terminals of my single generator, assume my single generator is running at 1 megacycle, and I set up the oscilloscope so that the horizontal axis represents a total of 1 microsecond, because a 1 megacycle signal goes through a whole cycle in 1 microsecond. So I set up the timing of the oscilloscope so from left side to right side, 1 microsecond of time has occurred, and because it's a 1 megacycle sine wave signal, I'll see on the left-hand side the curve will go up, on the right-hand side it'll go down, and at the end it comes back to zero again, if I synchronize it correctly. So I've got one pure sine wave on that oscilloscope, 1 megacycle signal generator, 1 microsecond of timing on the oscilloscope. It would really be a tenth of a microsecond per box on the oscilloscope, because there's usually 10 boxes across the screen horizontally. Okay? And those two waveforms, in the case of a pure resistor, I could lay them on top of each other after I readjust the gains correctly. I now take out that 50 ohm resistor, and I plug in my ideal inductor, and I've chosen the right value of the inductor, and we can calculate easily how many microhenry. There's a certain number of microhenry of inductor that at 1 megacycle gives me an inductive reactance of 50 ohms. So I've got the exact same impedance. I had a 50 ohm resistor before. Let me drop. I've now got an inductor that also acts like 50 ohms. And I could do this beautiful experiment. I'm lighting up my light bulb with my signal generator, and I put a 50 ohm resistor in series with the light bulb. I notice the amount of brilliance of the light bulb. I unplug the 50 ohm resistor, and I plug in a reactor that's also got 50 ohms of resistance. I'm going to get approximately the same amount of light out of the light bulb. I put in the same impedance, but there's a difference. I now put that 50 ohm inductive reactance, some number of microhenries, I put it across the terminals of my signal generator. I hook up the oscilloscope in the same way, and now I display current and voltage. The voltage waveform on the screen now will look identical to before, but the current waveform will look different. It will be delayed 90 degrees. What does that mean? That means the beginning of the sine wave on the voltage waveform will start at the left-hand side, go through one complete sine wave, and stop at the right-hand side. When I look at the current waveform for the inductor, it will go through zero, not at the left-hand side of the screen, but a quarter of the way between the left-hand side and the right-hand side. The inductor will start off down on the negative peak on the screen. That'll be the beginning of the screen, and it'll be the exact same waveform, but that waveform will be shifted to the right. We call that delay, because time is the horizontal axis on the scope. So the inductor, if it's an ideal inductor, will be the exact same waveform, but shifted, the current waveform will be shifted downrange by 90 degrees, a quarter wavelength in time. That represents a 90-degree phase shift. You could call it a positive phase shift if your method of referencing is that delay in time is called positive phase shift. There's other kinds of mathematics we use the other way. You got to be careful with your standards on this one.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So now I've got a little bit of a comparison between an inductor and a resistor. I now unplug that inductor, and I put in the right number of microfarads, or maybe it's a fraction of a microfarad, but I choose a capacitor, an ideal capacitor, that at my one megacycle that the signal generator is running, has again exactly 50 ohms of capacitive reactance. And I put it across the terminal of the signal generator. And I now hook up those scope probes the exact same way, and I measure current and voltage again. The voltage will look the same because I'm synchronizing to the voltage. That's the way I'm synchronizing my oscilloscope. The voltage waveform, which is called channel number one, we'll say. Channel number two is displaying the current waveform. And now the current will lead. Now, on the left-hand side, the current waveform will start off at the positive peak. And it will go through the zero in the negative going direction, a quarter of the screen to the right. So the current waveform, we call that leading in current. It happens sooner. So when you go through a capacitor, you tend to see leading current phase shift. That's what that oscilloscope is displaying for you. And it goes through zero delayed in time, but it's going through zero in the negative going direction, a quarter way from the left side toward the right-hand side of the screen. That will be a quarter of a microsecond to be exact. Whereas with the inductor, it'll start off with a negative peak, and it'll go through zero in a positive voltage going direction, again, a quarter of a microsecond downrange. So the waveforms will look very similar, but they're shifted in this funny way. Inductors tend to lag in current waveform, capacitors tend to lead. Once you recognize this shift in time that you see on the oscilloscope, once you understand the crazy words that are describing
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Once you understand the vocabulary that's used for leading current or lagging current on what you put across an inductor or a capacitor, now you can take those exact same inductor and capacitor that I described and put all three of them across the oscilloscope at the same time. The inductor, the capacitor, and the resistor. Put all three of those objects across that exact same terminals of the oscilloscope, and now I've set up my instrumentation so that I see current and voltage of the composite network. you'll get something very interesting. The current waveform and the voltage waveform will be the identical waveform of the pure 50 ohm resistor. There'll be no current phase shift. It'll be as if the inductor and the capacitor were not there. Because this ideal inductor with 50 ohms of reactance and the ideal capacitor with 50 ohms of reactance are put in parallel, they cancel each other. The composite network will have the current flow and the phase shift of a pure 50 ohm resistor. Ain't that crazy? But once you see that resonance phenomenon, once you then grab the frequency dial on that signal generator and go a little bit higher in frequency and a little bit lower in frequency, and you see the current waveform, which is now in phase at 1 megacycle, but it's going to start shifting in a funny way as you go away from resonance, you're now seeing what happens in a real LCR network. That would be a beautiful oscilloscope display that could be done in a laboratory. I wonder if you've ever seen anything quite like that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, of course, I was going to explain it to how I taught it in the past. I think I will let people, if they have a piece of paper, we will go through this a little slower because it is, at first hearing, complicated. But if I explain it very slow, I think you may be able to pick up on it. So if you have a piece of paper, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go strictly by simple impedance, basically start how Dick came up with this 90-degree angle and how that formed. So easiest way to do it, if you just take a piece of paper and draw a inductor in series with a resistor, and put across it, put across one side of the inductor, E, from the generator, and to the other side, a resistor, the other side of the generator. Now, the E, the line that's going to the inductor, put an arrow pointing to that and make that, mark that I. Next thing you can do, once you have this, mark the inductor as, say, EX and mark the resistor as ER. Let me let it drop and then I'll describe the next step so you can visualize it a little better. Okay, now you draw a right triangle. Okay? And at the 90 degree point, the line that goes up at the 90 degree point, if you put that line that goes up there, and mark that EX. The other line that on the other side of the 90 degree line, that would be the horizontal line, if you mark that ER. And then that means that the other line, the hypotenuse, what we call, we could mark that just plain E, or in parentheses, put a Z. Now you'll notice that there's an angle form, so that's when EX, if you look at EX, it is 90 degrees out of phase with the other line, the horizontal line, which is I. So there's how we just came up with this phase and current difference. Notice 90 degrees out of phase. If you picture it now on the triangle, that's what Dick was alluding to begin with, over.
Yeah, that diagram helps a lot. One slight problem, though, Mel. You'll only get that diagram. You'll only see the EX and ER at right angles to each other if the R and the X are in parallel with each other, and if I'm measuring the current that flows through the resistor or the current that flows through the reactor, then I will see this right angle relationship. If I put the inductor and the resistor in series, by definition, there's only one current flowing through a series network, and you can't get a different current magnitude or a current phase angle across the resistor or across the inductor when they're in series. Those two currents have to be in the same phase when they're in series. So series you have to analyze a little bit differently. And the way you're describing, I think, would happen easier if they were in parallel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I just think that it would be, you know, basically easier to visualize that there's a series, the inductor, the resistor is series. But what I was trying to really bring out, if EX is 90 degrees out of phase with the current I, while R, the current and the voltage, ER, become in phase. So what we're looking at here is EX is 90 degrees out of phase with ER. If you see that clearly, you can visualize it as a triangle. You're just looking straight at it. So what are we actually looking at? As Dick was talking about earlier, if the amplitude of these voltages would be represented, say, by straight lines drawn at right angles to each other. In other words, we're representing all these by actually looking at straight lines, and we're actually looking at them as they're drawn. This is the beginning, what I was trying to get at, as the, what we call quadrica. That is when we hear, you heard us mention quadrica. Q-U-A-D-R-A-T-U-R-E. This is the beginning of its definition. Over.
It sure is. And by the way, that series network that Mel just described, where he made a right angle triangle, and he knew the amount of reactance of the capacitor because he either calculated it knowing how many microfarads it was and what frequency he's operating at, or he measured it. So he knows the capacitor reactance, and that is the vertical line on that right triangle. He knows how many ohms of resistance he's got. That's the horizontal line. And when he puts them in series, they have a brand new composite impedance, and that is the hypotenuse of that triangle. And you know the way you measure the length of a hypotenuse of a triangle is the square root of the sum of the squares. So you take the EX magnitude, square it, take the ER magnitude, square it, sum them together, and take the square root of it, and that's the total impedance in ohms, which happens to equal the length on that diagram of the hypotenuse. So that diagram really allows you to see how you calculate the impedance when you put a reactance and a resistance in series with each other. And one of the next steps maybe Mel's going to do is he's going to put one more object in series, the opposite reactance. If the first one was a capacitor, he's going to add an inductor, and you'll see some interesting magic occur. Over to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick just brought up a very interesting point. You'll remember from simple mathematics that you remember that when a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Well, this is the same thing we're doing. E squared is equal to ER squared plus EX squared. In other words, the right triangle formula that you use, and you say, what good is this? How am I ever going to do it? Here is a perfect example of what Pythagoras came up with, a squared plus b squared, c squared. He never envisioned it being used in modern electronics, Dick, over.
Now, you could take Mel's right triangle, where he's got one line going straight up, one guy going straight to the right, and the line going straight up, usually, we're going to call that the reactance, and usually reactance being positive means an inductor. And if we take that upgoing line and extend it through the right angle portion, through the apex, yeah, and extend it downward, we would now call that negative reactance, and a capacitor creates negative reactance. So if you know that you're putting a certain amount of ohms of capacitor reactance, you're putting a capacitor in series with the inductor, in series with the resistor, and you're putting it across the signal generator, that's a LCR series network, and you do it using this diagram, because the capacitive reactance goes down, it's going to subtract from the upgoing reactant, and so those two vertical lines, one going up and one going down, you combine those two lines first, then the combination point, you complete that as a hypotenuse over to the right-hand side of that triangle. And you'll see very rapidly that the positive going line and the negative going line, if they happen to equal each other, call that resonance, all reactants cancel, you've got nothing but the horizontal line, you've got nothing but the pure resistor left. That's another way of looking at it as a diagram. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, let me back this up a little bit. This is K2KEY, what Dick was trying to say. Okay, the phase angle, that is the angle opposite to 90 degrees, where you see where we drew the, on a horizontal line, we said that was R, where it meets the other line at that point there and all, that we call the hypotenuse. If you remember basic algebra and all. At that point, we are measuring the phase. There is a time when the phase, what we call the phase angle, is something less than 90 degrees. And this is when the ratio of the reactant to resistance is different. So at this point, we're actually looking at the phase angle, which there's where you're, again, if you remember, the tangent of the angle would be equal to X over R. So this is when we are measuring the next factor of when the voltage lags behind the current. See, there's many factors in this. You can't jump too far ahead, Dick, over.
Okay, what Mel and I are going to be saying is that you may not make complete understanding of all this you hear it the first time. But when you hear it multiple times, explained from different people, different points of view, it'll eventually start making sense. And to try to explain capacitive reactance, inductive reactance, resistance, and leading and lagging phase angles, that can be pretty confusing. To make it into a trigonometric diagram can really help. And what Mel had you do was to draw a vertical line up, and that represented the magnitude, the strength, the size, so to speak, of the, in this case, inductive reactance. The horizontal line represented the magnitude, the size of the resistance. Both of them can be measured in ohms. So ohms of resistance is horizontal. Ohms of inductive reactance is vertical. You draw those two lines the right length, representing those magnitudes, those number of ohms. Let me drop. Connect that upgoing arrow, the tip of it, to the horizontal arrow, the tip of it. You connect the two. We call that the hypotenuse of the triangle. The length of the hypotenuse tells you the total impedance of the circuit in ohms. And by the Pythagorean theorem, if you remember that from your trigonometry, you know how to calculate the length of the hypotenuse. And where the hypotenuse meets the right-hand line, the E sub R line, that angle represents the phase angle of the current versus the voltage in that circuit. So now the L and the R in series have a certain phase angle of current versus voltage. Current phase angle, when you compare the current angle to the voltage angle on the oscilloscope I described before, and now trigonometrically you can see it. You can see that as the resistor goes towards zero, which means that horizontal line gets smaller and smaller, you're starting to make a very high, steep right triangle. That angle on the right-hand side starts opening up more and more, and becomes 90 degrees. That gives you a little bit of a feeling for how the current approaches 90 degrees on an ideal inductor when the series resistance goes to zero. So that trigonometric diagram is a way of displaying these current angles as a trigonometry, even though the mathematics that goes into it might seem a little bit crazy. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, we started out just basically describing basic impedance just now, whereas basic impedance is defined as the ratio of voltage to current. For instance, V equals E over I. This triangle that we just had drawn, as Dick just more or less made it more understandable, I may not have conveyed it as well as he did, is basically what we call the R, X, and Z impedance triangle for a series circuit. So, and a trigonometry, the phase angle, we represent that by, you look like a little zero with a line horizontally through it. If you want to find that phase angle, the exact measures of phase angle, you take your figures of X and over the R, and it's equal to the tangent of zero. So in other words, once you do that X over R, and then you look up the tangent of that figure that you get, that will give you the phase angle measurement. So this is how we get into a term that many people may have heard us say, quadrature. This is its basics, Dick. I think that's what we can't jump ahead. Now I hope people get a little understanding what we're talking about when we get into things like quadrature, et cetera. Over.
KC2RF. John recognized. I'm going to go to John in about a minute and a half. One of the things that wasn't made clear to me in the beginning, and I went an awful far downrange in my early electronics training in my teenage years, is I sort of understood Ohm's law. If I wanted to measure how many ohms is an unknown resistor, R equals E over I. In other words, it puts some kind of volt ohm milliammeter, digital voltmeter, or whatever. I put 1 volt on the resistor, and I measure how much current that flows through it. If I put 1 volt on the resistor and 1 ampere flows, I'm dividing 1 by 1. You put the voltage on the top and the current on the bottom, and that's what Ohm's law says. R equals E over I. E represents voltage. It should be V over I, if you want to be simple, if you know what I mean. And that's what your ohm meter does. It tries to put a certain amount of voltage across the unknown. It measures how much current is left. That's what deflects the needle on an old-fashioned vacuum tube voltmeter. And the scale we have is ohms. I sort of understood that. What I didn't understand is that if I did the same experiment, let me drop, where now the source of the voltage is not just a 1 volt battery. That's what's inside of your ohm meter, a 1.5 volt battery in most cases, on the old-fashioned ohm meter. But it's now a signal generator that generates 1 volt. And you measure how much current you measure. And now because it's a sine wave signal generator, 1 volt of signal generator makes some sense. 1 ohm, if my inductive reactor or my capacitive reactor happen to have a reactance of 1 ohm, again I would get 1 ampere flowing. So it's the exact same formula. Instead of the word R equals E over I, you could say X at that frequency equals E over I. And you measure it in ohms, even though it's at right angles. It's hard to believe that the capacitive reactance is still measured in ohms. It still follows the Ohm's law of voltage divided by current, but now it's an AC voltage at that frequency. That still tells you the number of ohms of either inductive reactance or capacitor reactance. Or it could tell you the total amount of ohms of impedance of a circuit if it's a more complicated circuit with R's and L's and C's combined in some kind of a series or parallel network. But still, ohms of reactance and ohms of resistance are the same ohms. That was not made real clear to me at first, and it was kind of confusing downrange until it all came together, if you know what I mean. Alan, KC2RFN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick and Mel. Mel, a question for you, just clarification. You, I think, were referring to theta, the phase angle of theta, and I assume you were then referring to the tangent of theta, which was the opposite side over the adjacent side in your right triangle. Is that correct?
Oh, we can assume, okay, in the right triangle, as Dick said, the vertical line, if we draw a right triangle, the E, that would represent the EX, and the horizontal line, 90-degree line, horizontal line, we can represent that as ER, and the hypotenuse as Z, or just plain E. So, if you want to use that type of this diagram, saying, in other words, that vertical line is the X and the horizontal 90 degree, the horizontal line is the R, then X over R would be equal to the tangent of that angle, the beta angle. Is that clear, over?
From your original question, John, I say the answer was yes. You had it right the way you asked it. So you've got the right formula, John, for measuring phase angle. I said John, I meant Alan. I'm sorry about that. You got it, Alan.
That's okay, Dick. I'm an identical twin. I've been called the wrong name my whole life. No problem there. All right, so that's what I thought. They touched on that a bit in my ham extra exam, but I had never been exposed to that before. Maybe a little bit of resonant circuitry in college physics, but that was it. So that leads me to my next question. Mel, you taught this. Is there a textbook that you used that broke this down? And not just this part, but impedance, power, you know, all of that in a textbook. And is there one available possibly geared toward radio specifically? And does it have lab experiments in it as well? Some sort of academic text, Mel?
It was a book. I don't know if it's still available. It was called Mathematics for Electronics, or Mathematics for Radio, I think. I'd have to look. Most likely on my bookshelf, I give you all the info on the book. I actually taught it basically the way it was drummed into me. You've got to remember, I was at this since I was 14, going to Brooklyn Tech. 4 years of it there, and then on to college and whatnot. So I've repeated this over and over again, so, you know, I can come up with it verbatim. But if you don't understand, see, this is it. This is the root. This is the foundation of all this, the impedance triangle, basically. That's what I used to call it, the impedance triangle. I don't know if they refer to it as that anymore. But understanding that to begin with, then you can go on to the next step. When we started before talking about the resistance and reactance in parallel or in series, that's a thing called admittance. See, we're jumping. We can't jump to that, which is the next step, which would be admittance, until we thoroughly understand this basic impedance. Okay, over.
Oh, absolutely. That's why I was hoping there was a text on it. It's not that difficult to understand, but when the only source most of us have is from review books for the amateur exams, it would be nice to go a little bit more detail with it and to be able to reference it and use it for projects and things like that. So I follow you 100%, but I have not found any books that will lay it out clearly like that. And I figured probably something like a high school text that was geared toward radio had it very clearly and could act as a teaching text as well as a reference text And even better, if it has some lab experiments in it, you can just sit at your bench and play with it. And Dick, that whole scenario you talked about, how you hook up your resistor and then you add in an inductor and a capacitor, that's exactly what I want to do. And I want to see that on the oscilloscope and then build up from there. That's why I was hoping to get a text. These ARRL books think for that. They don't really teach it that way. Those books are really written almost as reviews after the fact. They're not really good for teaching, in my opinion, you know, from the ground up. They're not good primers. K2RFM, Dick.
Wait a minute. I'll give them the edition of the book.
You got it, Milton.
Okay, listen, the book is called Practical Electronics Math. Practical Electronics Math. It is written by Belly, B-E-L-E-Y, and Doolin, D-U-L-I-N. It was originally sold by, let me see, TAB, T-A-B Books. TAB Books, printed in 1980. That was the first edition. Let's see, it is available, let's see, Library of Congress, catalog. Okay, it's in the Library of Congress, so I guess you can access this book or buy. Maybe it's still available, I don't know. But it's excellent. This is what it goes through, the whole rigmarole with all this from the beginning to end, over.
All right, thanks, Bill. I'll look that up. I appreciate it. It's exactly what I was looking for. Okay, back to that.
And since that was a 1980 book, there's a medium good chance that somewhere on the web you can get a copy of it. I just Googled the word combination LC. I Googled RLC circuit plus wiki. So I went to Google, and I used as a search RLC circuit plus wiki, and I got a fairly nice website. Not quite as good on the reactance triangle as Mel just told us about, but quite a bit of the mathematics is there. Damping networks, I see a series network, and yeah, Mel's right. I should have gone to series circuit first, because almost always that's the way it's taught. Series circuit first, parallel circuit second. And believe it or not, there is an exact duality between the two. You can take any series circuit, make it into an equivalent parallel circuit, and vice versa. But don't fall into the trap. It's only good at the one frequency you calculated for. And as you sweep away from that frequency, the two circuits diverge, the series equivalent and the parallel equivalent. So gotta be careful you don't fall into that particular trap. Not easy at first, good things to know, and when you start calculating now where the currents are flowing, what phase angles are the currents flowing, and believe it or not, any current that flows that is at truly right angles, in other words, any real current, you could break it into a in-phase component and a quadrature component, an out-of-phase component and an in-phase component, so to speak. Good job.
Nobody was taught properly.
So if you're taught properly, it's series first, is what I think you're saying. But it's only the in-phase component that's capable of dissipating power. The quadrature component doesn't dissipate power. That's the so-called reactive power. And you can have a lot of fun with your electrical engineering friends, even the ones that are very smart in electronics with radio electronics, and transmission lines. And they all know that if you take a 50-ohm transmission line, put a pure 50-ohm resistor at the far end, whatever signal you send down that transmission line, every bit of it gets coupled into that load resistor, and none of it reflects back. That's a given. But then you tell somebody, I'm going to put a perfect 50-ohm capacitive reactance at the end of the line. And they know that now that the capacitor reactance, 50 ohms, equals the impedance of the transmission line. And you ask them, what is the standing wave ratio? How much power is reflected from that situation? More than half of them will say, no power is reflected. It's a 50 ohm load on a 50 ohm transmission line. Well, because the current is at right angles in that inductor, none of it gets absorbed, none of it gets dissipated. Therefore, there's no energy absorption characteristic at the end of that line. Every bit of it gets reflected because of conservation of energy. So you put a pure 50 ohm perfect capacitor or inductor at the end of your transmission line, you have an infinite spanning wave ratio. Every watt you send down will come back toward you. And as I said, more than half of the really smart radio engineers get a little bit confused on that one. They haven't quite remembered that the impedance triangle that they were in theory taught in the very beginning. K2RIW listening.
K2KEY, one more thing.
You got it, Mel.
We've discussed a number of times that the method of education today in the engineering field. I will tell you, I have taught at a fairly prestigious college for a while in New York, and I told a couple of them to just explain it. Simple. Oh, rattled it off. Draw me a diagram. Now, this is not much to draw this simple diagram, do it by this triangle method to explain it. You know, they really did not, they were passed on. They don't have the right founder. This is not taught correctly, and that's why I sympathize with just what Alan said. You look at the ARRL handbook, something has gone amiss because it is not represented correctly. They start into the subject at the beginning. I just looked in the new handbook, and it's not covered correctly. It's just not taught correctly, and that's why most people don't understand these things. And let them digest this before we go on, because if you don't have this foundation, you can't go to the next step, over.
KC2RFM.
Yeah, Alan recognized, but first, Mel, when you're unhappy with the presentation of L, R, and C, the reactances, one of the very early chapters in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you're unhappy with that presentation, tell me what the degree of your unhappiness is, and then pass it over to Alan. You got it, Mel.
If you look at it, Dick, this is K2KEY, by the way, if you look at it, you could read that over a dozen times and you will not understand as much as I just did by taking the simple triangle and representing it by that. I will bet you more people now understood from this simple diagram, visualizing it, than can read in that book on and in half that chapter, Dick, over.
You got it, Alan.
And I want to agree with that. That's 100% right. And I'm glad to hear you say that, Mel. Because whenever I sit down with one of these ARRL books, I sit down and read it as if I'm reading a college textbook in preparation for an exam. And I go through it step by step, and I write notes as I go along. And these books jump. I've been halfway through the antenna book, and I've read every single word and every single line and tried to take it in context. And I have come to the conclusion that at least 70% of the time, they make a leap from one area to another area as if they've already laid a firm foundation for the first area, which they haven't, and then they jump inappropriately to the next area, and then, of course, you're lost. They throw a few formulas at you. Formulas are easy. All you have to do is plug in the numbers, right? But they don't lay the conceptual foundation for what it is they're trying to teach. And unless I can understand that I can build a conceptual basis, I can't use the information. It's not fun as a hobby. I can pass a test. I mean, I did that all through college. I can learn concepts and pass the test easily without really understanding them because I just plug in the numbers. But here, let me just drop. Here, there is a huge disconnect between what's written in these books and reality. It's not really written sequentially. It just sort of jumps around and it misses key elements. And I've actually written notes. I can send my copy of the antenna handbook to the ARRL, and they can rewrite it to include the things I've written as question marks. Where is this explained? Where is that explained? So it's good to hear that you agree there is a disconnect here. And